Hello, everyone. This episode is recorded by myself. I'll let the introduction carry out as normal. Hello, future doctors. You're tuning into Spoonful of Sugar, the podcast made for and by medical students, where we break down complex medical topics into bite-sized pieces for your success. I'm your host, Bilal Rana, a third year at Western University, and today we're going to look at easy ways to understand cerebrospinal fluid pathology. This is a two-part series. This episode will concern hydrocephalus, and the next one will be talking about CSF infections. So, as per usual, I'll be doing this in a question and answer format. Don't worry if you get any wrong. This is the time to get it wrong before the exam. Before we do that, we're going to go and do a brief anatomy overview, so that way we have a better idea of what we're referring to. When we're discussing cerebrospinal fluid pathology, which I'll forever be referring to as CSF since that's a mouthful, we want to talk about how the CSF flows. But before that, let's briefly talk about what CSF is. It's just a set of fluid that circulates around the brain, cushions it, prevents it from injury, and also provides nutrients. Now, where it flows is going to be important for our purposes of discussion this time. So let's begin by looking at the lateral ventricles. So CSF is going to start in the two lateral ventricles. They're then going to travel to the third ventricle via the interventricular foramen of Monroe. From the third ventricle, the CSF will then travel to the fourth ventricle via the cerebral aqueduct, sometimes also referred to as the aqueduct of Sylvius. And then from the fourth ventricle, you have two choices. You're either going to go laterally or medially. The CSF that flows laterally flows through the foramen of Luschka. The way I remember this is the L in Luschka stands for lateral. And then medially, you have the foramen of Majendie. The M for Majendie stands for medial. And then all of that drains into the subarachnoid space. For our first question, I want to ask, where is CSF made? So CSF is made in the choroid plexus. And of course, what needs to be made can't be perpetually making things, otherwise we'll get an overload. So we're going to need to reabsorb these somehow. How is CSF reabsorbed? By the arachnoid granulations. So if there are any problems within the anatomy that would cause there to be too much CSF, we then have hydrocephalus. Now, hydrocephalus literally means waterhead, so it's when you have too much CSF in the ventricles. Now we're going to be discussing the different types of hydrocephalus. The first type of hydrocephalus is a communicating hydrocephalus. So this would be best explained by an analogy. So imagine you have a sink. So you open the faucet and you have water that is coming out. Think of that as the production. And then you have the drain. Think of that as the reabsorption. So, if you have too much CSF in the brain, then it is either because you are producing too much or you are not draining enough. The one that you will be most likely to encounter is when you're not draining enough. And there are two types that you're going to want to know. There's the type of communicating cephalus that happens acutely due to less drainage, and the one that occurs chronically. So just to pose a very open-ended question, what is an acute cause of hydrocephalus? So an acute cause of hydrocephalus would be secondary to meningitis. And what meningitis will do is it will scar the arachnoid granulations. Now recall that the arachnoid granulations are what reabsorb the CSF. And what meningitis will do is cause scarring of these granulations, which will prevent the reabsorption of CSF. Now, what is a chronic cause of communicating hydrocephalus? The one you're going to want to know, and it'll show up everywhere, I promise you, it's normal pressure hydrocephalus. Now, how do we recognize normal pressure hydrocephalus? What are some of the symptoms you need to be looking out for? So there's a classic triad. You have urinary incontinence, a wide-based gait, and confusion. So this is sometimes referred to as wet, wobbly, and wacky. Now, what is the pathophysiology surrounding normal pressure hydrocephalus? So the pathophysiology largely idiopathic, but generally speaking, these symptoms occur due to distortion of the corona radiata. You might need to know this. And if you were to do a lumbar puncture, what kind of pressure would you get? Yeah, normal pressure. It sounds kind of counterintuitive. You would think by having hydrocephalus, you should have increased pressure, but you have a normal pressure hydrocephalus. Very strange, but don't get thrown off if you see a normal lumbar puncture pressure. One good detail to know is that lumbar punctures can improve the symptoms, but definitive treatment is ventriculoperitoneal shunting, also known as VP shunting. You probably don't need to know that detail for step one, but I just thought I'd throw that in there just in case. So those are the two causes that you need to know pertaining to less drainage. Now, what happens if we have a communicating hydrocephalus due to more production? What will we call this? So the specific term you're going to need to know is choroid plexus papilloma. Pretty much exactly what it sounds like. It's a cancer of sorts that happens in the choroid plexus. And recall we mentioned that CSF is made by the choroid plexus. And this usually happens in kids. Very unlikely you're going to see a presentation like this in adults. Now let's move on to the non-communicating hydrocephalus. I need to explain the difference between communicating and non-communicating, so that way we know very clearly which one is which. So the reason that the communicating hydrocephalus is called a communicating hydrocephalus is because there is still some drainage. In other words, there is still a communication between the production and the area where it's drained. But when it is completely blocked, as in there's no way for the production to meet the drainage in any way, this is what we call non-communicating hydrocephalus. So what do you think would cause a non-communicating hydrocephalus? Literally any kind of blockage. Specifically, the ones you want to familiarize yourself are any kind of brain tumor or congenital malformations. Now, this is very detailed and it deserves its own episode. However, I will refer you to the episode on brain tumors written by Oliver on Season 3, Episode 3, and forgo any questions on this matter because I don't want to reinvent the wheel. But generally speaking, if you want to know how to quickly distinguish a non-communicating versus a communicating hydrocephalus by symptoms, you'll see a similar pattern of symptoms, but the differences in non-communicating hydrocephalus, you'll often see accompanying cranial nerve deficits. Okay, that's it for non-communicating hydrocephalus. Now we're going to move on to this next term called hydrocephalus ex vacuo. Now, what is hydrocephalus ex vacuo? So it refers to when the CSF amount increases due to a decrease in brain size. That is very important. So when we're thinking a decrease in brain size, what kind of pathology should we be thinking of? Yeah, neurological pathologies like Alzheimer's. And whenever you see a fancy sounding term, it's helpful to kind of break down the etymology. So we already know hydrocephalus means waterhead. Ex vacuo is Latin for out of nothing or to make empty. So hopefully that helps you remember that this is a CSF increase, hydrocephalus, due to a decrease in brain size, as if nothing is there. So that's the ex vacuo component. The problem with hydrocephalus ex vacuo is that it sounds like another old person hydrocephalus like NPH. So you might be wondering, what's the difference? So the key difference is the finding on MRI. Okay, so what would you see on MRI for hydrocephalus ex vacuo? So you would see two things. You would see ventriculomegaly, just as you would in NPH. But in addition, you will also see cortical atrophy, very high yield. We should know this. Additionally, for the purposes of board exams, NPH has an idiopathic cause, kind of as I alluded to earlier. But hydrocephalus ex vacuo has a clear cause, the decrease in brain size. And I gave the example of Alzheimer's. Now, if any of what I said was confusing, that's okay. You're more likely to be asked about NPH than hydrocephalus ex vacuo. So when in doubt, go with the former. But again, if you see a clear cause, you might want to lean towards the latter. Okay, and that is all for the hydrocephalus. Let's do some quick practice questions. So we have a 68-year-old female. She was brought in by her daughter due to recurrent falls. Patient denies any changes to vision. On the physical exam, cranial nerves 2 through 12 are intact. Muscle strength is plus 5 out of 5 bilaterally in the upper and lower extremities. Her gait is slow with a wide base. And further questioning reveals that the patient has been urinating herself on occasion and is frequently forgetting to take her medications. What's the diagnosis here? So the diagnosis is normal pressure hydrocephalus. Now, let's go over why that is. So we noticed in the question stem that her gait is slow with a wide base. Now, sometimes we just remember the words and we don't really think about it, but just imagine if you had to catch your balance. You wouldn't want to stand narrow, right? You wouldn't want to stand tall. You would want to stand wide to keep your balance. So people who have difficulty with balance, you're going to see them walk with a wide base, as in their legs are spread further apart. You also notice the recurrent falls, so that kind of further explains the loss of balance. And then the further questioning reveals the patient's been urinating herself. That's the urinary incontinence, so we already have the wobbly and the wet. And then the frequently forgetting to take her medications is a subtle way of saying that, you know, she's starting to lose some of her cognitive functioning. So what would you find on an MRI? An MRI scan will show ventriculomegaly. Now, what if it also shown signs of cortical atrophy? Then it would be hydrocephalus ex vacuo, and an example of a neurological condition that could cause cortical atrophy? Yeah, Alzheimer's. Now, as a bonus question, which lobe of the brain is atrophied in Alzheimer's? The temporal lobe. It's good to know they may ask you that, so I figured I'd throw it in here. Next question. An 11-month-old boy is brought into the office due to an inability to sit upright and increased irritability. Further questioning reveals that he has had an increase in nausea and vomiting. On physical exam, you appreciate a bulging anterior fontanelle. What is the diagnosis here? Now, of course, this question stem is pretty minimal, but given the context of this episode, it's likely to be choroid plexus papilloma. Recall from earlier, I mentioned that this is a communicating hydrocephalus due to increase in production that mostly happens in kids. So common symptoms you're going to see are irritability, nausea, and vomiting. And what would you see on an MRI? So on an MRI, you're going to appreciate a mass within the ventricles. So you're actually going to see a, you know, specific mass. I know I didn't mention that earlier on, but that's just something that you're going to want to know for choroid plexus papilloma, because it's a papilloma, it's a mass. Other things to look out for are milestone delays. In this example, it was pretty subtle. The patient is 11 months old and can't sit upright. Typically, you would expect a baby to sit up within the first 6 months of life, maybe 7 or 8, but 11 months is a little bit of a delay. So that's another something that you might be able to appreciate. A little harder since developmental delays are a difficult topic, so don't worry if you don't get that right away. Last question. We have an 18-year-old brought into the emergency room complaining of fatigue, headache, nausea, and vomiting. Vital signs are a temperature of 103 degrees Fahrenheit, a blood pressure of 88 over 52, and a heart rate of 150. Physical exam shows a diffuse maculopapular rash. The patient is admitted with droplet precautions and treated with ceftriaxone and vancomycin and discharged after over a week of treatment. She then returns to the emergency room 2 weeks later with nausea and vomiting while also complaining of urinary incontinence. And physical exam is revealing a wide-based gait. So, what is the pathophysiology behind this patient's condition? So to kind of work step by step, the diagnosis here is a communicating hydrocephalus. And this isn't an old person communicating hydrocephalus. This is one that is secondary to meningitis. The pathophysiology in this case is the scarring of the arachnoid granulations. Now, That question might have been easy given the context of this episode, but this question serves as a reminder to always read the last sentence of the question stem and the answer choices first to save time. Because otherwise what's going to happen is you'll be sitting there figuring out the treatment for meningococcal meningitis when it was already given in the question stem and you had to answer something else. Of course, it's not possible during the podcast to read ahead, but definitely possible during your studies and exam. And by way of review, let's go over everything real quick one more time. So the anatomy, we have two lateral ventricles draining through the interventricular foramen of Monroe into the third ventricle, then through the cerebral aqueduct, aka the aqueduct of Sylvius, into the fourth ventricle, then splitting into the foramen of either Luschka or Majandi, lateral and medial respectively, and then to the subarachnoid space. CSF is made by the choroid plexus, reabsorbed by arachnoid granulations. We have three types of hydrocephalus that you need to know: communicating, non-communicating, and hydrocephalus ex vacuo. For communicating, you want to know the acute cause, which is scarring of the arachnoid granulations secondary to meningitis. And chronically, you're going to want to know the highest yield of these, of all the topics we've discussed so far: normal pressure hydrocephalus, characterized by a wet, wobbly, wacky triad, urinary continence, wide base gait, and confusion. And this occurs due to distortion of the corona radiata. You also want to know the choroid plexus papilloma. This is due to more production as opposed to less drainage and most commonly occurs in kids. Look out for the irritability symptoms, nausea, vomiting, and even milestone delays. As far as the non-communicating hydrocephalus, I know we didn't go over it in too much detail because to really understand these, you need to understand the brain tumors, which there's a separate episode written by Oliver, season 3, episode 3. Highly recommend, it helped me a bunch. But in general, these are a blockage caused by either tumors or congenital malformations. And you want to look out for cranial nerve deficits if you do suspect a hydrocephalus of a non-communicating type. And lastly, we have hydrocephalus ex vacuo. This is due to a decrease in brain size. Think of pathologies like Alzheimer's. And an MRI will not only show ventriculomegaly, but also cortical atrophy. Alright everyone, and that is all for part 1 of hydrocephalus. Thank you for tuning into Spoonful of Sugar. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or if you want to make an episode yourself, please visit our website at spoonfulofsugar.org. Good luck with studying, and remember that if you ever have an SOS moment while studying, Spoonful of Sugar is always here to help the medicine go down.